This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with an av geek and blogger who works in the office at a medium-sized airport in the Midwest. She has a lot of interesting information about how an airport operates. We also talk about a rebate for ADS-B installations, the Airbus A380, the spat between Delta and Qatar, and the Blue Angels and Thunderbird accidents. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 404 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. With me is first Rob Mark. Rob, are you calling in from an airport?
I am, as a matter of fact. I am at our local community airport, Chicago Executive Airport, for an event which I told them I was running out of for just a few minutes because I had something really important I had to take care of, but I'd be back soon. So that was at least the story I gave them until they hear this, I think.
All right. Well, good. We appreciate you prioritizing the show that way. That's great.
I know
stuff.
Where my butter's breaded or something like that.
Something like that. Also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max T, how are you? We haven't talked to you in kind of a while.
Hey, it's been a couple of weeks, and all I can say is I'm not in an airport now, but I did spend most of the day at the Palo Alto Airport teaching flying lessons and stuff, so I had great fun. We've got a brand new DA-40NG that burns diesel fuel, so that's been fun checking people out in that aircraft.
Very nice. All right. Also joining us is our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, I just wanted to say happy anniversary to the crew. Believe it or not, in 2010, we recorded on June 6th, and it was our 100th episode. So happy, 6th anniversary to us for celebrating 100 episodes and 304 later.
I think it's about our 8th year birthday as well, somewhere maybe in a few days.
Isn't David our only historian, though?
That's why he's our favorite historian.
Oh, okay. I was just curious.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I'm now in my terrible twos because I've been here for about 2 years.
Boy, time flies.
Actually, we were going to talk to you about that, Max.
Well, a number of people have tried. It hasn't worked.
No. Let's introduce our guest for this episode. It's Jennifer Adams. Jennifer works for the accounting department of a medium-sized airport in the Midwest. Now, she's a passionate av geek, and when she isn't buried in spreadsheets and calculating landing fees, she tends to spend her break time plane spotting, talking about aviation with just about anybody who will listen. She also writes the blog Tales from the Terminal. She shares stories there about her adventures in aviation, her love of the airport, and her not-so-secret desire to own a stairs truck. Jennifer, welcome to the show. A stairs truck? Really?
Hello. Yes, thanks for having me. And yeah, a stairs truck, really. And by the way, I spent most of my day at an airport also.
Well, that's why we wanted to talk with you, Jennifer, because we've talked with some of the folks who operate airports, some airport general managers and so forth. And we wanted to kind of learn about what goes on in an airport from kind of a different angle. So it's great to have Jennifer with us, as we said, a passionate av geek who can kind of tell us a little bit more about what goes on behind the scenes at an airport.
Yeah, we're not expecting any dirt or anything, Jen, but if you have some, then that would be fine, too.
Yeah, unfortunately, no exciting dirt. Sorry. There's dirt in the basement. I've been down there and I've seen that. So, yeah.
An airport has a basement?
It does indeed, a big one. And every time I have to go down there, I tell my coworkers where I'm going and tell them if I'm not back in 40 minutes to get one of the canines to go down and search for me.
Okay.
Wow. It's big. It's big. And there's lots, it's like a maze down there, all kinds of passages running every which way. So I'm always afraid I'm going to get lost.
All right. Well, we better get launched with the aviation news for this episode. So I'll ask, is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
Hey, kicking off the news, we have an item from AvWeb, FAA, ADS-B rebate. Today, as we record this, the FAA announced that it's going to offer $500 rebates, in some cases, to owners who install ADS-B out systems. What's going on here?
Well, this fits in with a conversation that I had with one of the people who announced this today. So Deputy FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker was out here a couple of weeks ago, and I spent a couple hours with him over a couple of days. And one of the things he was very emphatic about was that the deadline for ADS-B will not slip. He was just totally adamant that come January 1, 2020, that's when everybody has to be equipped. And so I think they've been looking for ways to try and move people along. There are just too many airplanes that need to be equipped. I mean, the fleet is about 200,000 airplanes, only about 20,000 are equipped. If you look at the total number of slots available at avionics shops between now and 2020, they might not be able to get them all equipped, even if people started installing today. So I think this is rather clever on their part to come up with a rebate to try and encourage people to start equipage sooner than later. What they announced was a $500 rebate for the next 20,000 aircraft to get equipped with ADS-B. So the people who move first are the ones that are going to get some money.
And what does an ADS-B cost?
Well, a couple grand, but that doesn't include installation. So you can figure installation probably doubles the cost. So yeah, you're probably looking at $4,000 installed.
And isn't the FAA kind of favoring certain GA aircraft, certain single-engine piston aircraft, I think, in this rebate program?
I think what they said was that of the people who've equipped so far, most of them were GA. I don't know that the rebate is intended to favor GA, but perhaps if it is, I missed that.
Yeah. I think I saw something like that that said the rebate essentially was only going to apply to single-engine piston airplanes because that's the chunk of the fleet they're most worried about, because business airplanes, charter airplanes, they're all going to get that done. I think the other point is that people are not getting the message. When they said the deadline is really not going to change, a lot of people still believe, the deadline's going to change. And they may be in for a real surprise in that'd be about 3.5 years.
Yeah, you'd be ill-advised to plan on there being a push out of the deadline.
Yeah, you might find your aircraft grounded for 6 months until you could, get a spot to get it included. But, to be clear, not everybody needs to get their airplane equipped. ADS-B is only required if you're going to be flying in Class Bravo, Charlie, above 10,000 feet. So, there are going to be folks in, outside of metro areas who might go, I didn't need a transponder. I don't need ADS-B. So I still think the majority of GA planes will equip. Just gives them a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, one thing David and I run into over at the UAV Digest frequently is the thought about using ADS-B for drones. And if there's a solution to some of the issues there that involves ADS-B, some interesting things going on, try to miniaturize and reduce the cost and so forth. Speaking of drones, Jennifer, do you have a drone problem at the airport where you work?
Define drone problem.
do you have incursions or anything of that sort?
A drone problem means you're running out of room in your garage for all the drones that you own. That's a drone problem.
We had an incident to say it was maybe 2 or 3 months ago, there was an incident. Actually, it involved a model airplane. So I don't know if you want to lump that in with drones or if that's its own category, really.
Well, that's the FAA says that a model airplane now is a drone. So we can lump that in.
Okay. Well, so yes, there was an incident with a model airplane. And, you know, a lot of times when you hear about drone incidents, it's reported and they send someone out, but they can never find the drone or the person who is flying it. But in this particular case, they did find the model airplane and the guy who was flying it. He was on the approach path, and at least two pilots reported that his plane was awfully close to theirs. They, I think, referred to it as a near miss. And his response was that he's done it all the time. He doesn't think it's a problem, and planes have navigation and stuff.
Oh, I hope they nailed his butt to the wall.
I'm sure. I'm sure they probably are quite busy doing that. I know, I remember when I read about it that the president of one of the model airplane associations just
That's
was
probably
really
Bob Brown of AMA.
Somebody local, but was just, they were very upset about it. And, you know, obviously responsible model plane owners, responsible drone owners, it makes you really angry when you see someone being careless. It then, you know, sort of drags down everybody else with them.
Well, going from the very small to the very large, we have an item concerning the Airbus A380. Airbus reveals plan for even more passengers on A380 aircraft. Who found this? Was that you, Max T?
Oh, I did. Yeah. In fact, there are a couple Airbus stories this past week. This was the one, you know, Brian, if he were here, would be absolutely screaming about. I mean, right now, the A380, you sit 10 abreast, so you and your 9 best friends. But the new plan is to add one friend to the row, which will add 60 people to the aircraft. It's like, if it's not already big enough, this is really going to make the A380, you know, like a small city, I think.
Wow. There's kind of a limit. There's also the issue of being able to park the aircraft at the gate when you've got an A380. It doesn't just fit into any old gate. And obviously some airports have created gates for that. This sort of flows into another item that we saw. This is in Business Insider. This is called "The Nastiest Feud in the Airline Business Has Reached Soap Opera Worthy Levels."
This was cool. I thought this was really cool.
This was pretty interesting, wasn't it? So what we have is we have Qatar Airways, Emirates, Etihad, and Delta Airlines don't see eye to eye when it comes to international agreements. In fact, Delta believes that the Middle Eastern carriers are benefiting from subsidies that violate the U.S. Open Skies agreements. And this has recently come to a head with Qatar Airways' inaugural flight to Atlanta, and the conversation really amped up. Now, on this route, Qatar is really intending to use 777s, Boeing 777s, but for the inaugural flight, they wanted to bring over an A380. I can kind of see that. Make a big splash for your first flight into Atlanta, and it kind of got weird from there. David, did you follow this at all?
An A380 needs a double-decker gate, and Atlanta's got a couple, but they were already going to be taken up and being used by Delta. So the airport informed Qatar that, you know, you're going to get over here and there's going to be no gate for you. And believe it or not, they flew the airplane over and had to deplane the airplane out on one of the, I don't know, what we used to call it when I used to fly in O'Hare, the penalty boxes, one of the auxiliary aprons. And they had to manually deplane the airplane because Delta wasn't giving up the gates so that Qatar could land to prove a point. It's really kind of amazing.
Well, I thought it got worse than that. I mean, apparently the airport has a policy that you need 60-day advance notice, and Qatar made the notice less than 6 weeks. So they were, you know, they didn't even meet the deadline. But then they turned around, and they had some really nasty things to say about Delta. I mean, I think it's pretty bad if you know that you didn't meet the aircraft's rules, and therefore you knew you weren't going to be able to use the gate. But then turn around and slam Delta. And boy, the stuff they said, it was something like, you know, Delta purposely inconvenienced our handicapped and senior passengers. I mean, that's pretty low blow, I think.
Yeah, the CEO called Delta wicked, according to a Bloomberg report, and said that its actions were, quote, an absolute violation of the air services agreement. But then it goes on, because in May, Qatar celebrated the launch of this Atlanta route at the Fox Theater. This is a historic theater, Fox Theater. Yeah, they held a party there that had a performance by Jennifer Lopez, right? So this is not some small little shindig. So as a result of that, Delta Airlines has announced that they will no longer sponsor this Fox Theater landmark. So it's just kind of crazy.
Boy, these guys are really being mean to each other. Did you see that our friend Richard, whose last name you can pronounce better than I, Richard
Abulafia.
There we go. Yeah, he had an article that was out today in Forbes, in which he was talking about how basically Emirates has pretty much given up on the A380 ever being re-engined, and now they're just hoping it stays in production. And so the number of orders left on the books is really small. I think they said they might only build 18 next year. So, boy, it's kind of on the death watch.
Emirates, of course, is the largest operator of the A380. Some people, you know, refer to the A380 as, you know, the Emirates plane. And that's been something they've been pushing for very strongly, is to try to make it more efficient, hopefully by doing things like stretching it, bring more seats in, lower the cost per seat mile, or an A380, quote, neo kind of an approach with newer, more fuel-efficient engines. And Airbus has resisted that, I think, and this is just me, I think in part because those are very expensive things to do for an airplane that has, very limited volume. It just doesn't make economic sense for them to do that. So, yeah, it's very interesting to see that Emirates is kind of backed off from that. And, they're making more rational statements about the future of the A380.
Yeah, and I found the numbers here. They said that Airbus said that they could be producing as few as 20 aircraft next year, which is far below the 30 aircraft needed for annual, break even. And that there were only 67 A380 orders left in the entire backlog.
Yeah.
Oh boy, it's going to go away. Either that, or they're going to make it a tanker,
or maybe a large A-10.
That would be one hell. That would be one hell of a gun. One hell of a target too, if it's flying low and slow.
Yeah, so that could make it an A380 drone, huh?
Yeah, wow. There you go.
No, what's a drone? A Q, right? Oh, but that doesn't apply. Q doesn't apply outside the U.S., does it, David?
No. As a general rule, Q is a U.S. designation, yeah, for drones.
Oh, okay.
Again, we're speaking with Jennifer Adams. Jen, again, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, we're so happy to have you. Tell us a little bit about the airport where you work, sort of the size, some of the characteristics of the airport.
And maybe the four-letter identifier as well. No, I'm just kidding.
nice try. So I just, by way of explanation, I thought I would start by just explaining that there's actually multiple airports that we handle. Primarily, I'm going to talk about the passenger airport, but there are a couple of others, one of them being primarily cargo and one of them being primarily general aviation. But to give you an idea of the size of the airport, we're talking about roughly 7 million passengers a year. And of that, we're talking roughly 3.5 million emplanements. And emplanements, of course, are people getting onto an airplane. We're talking roughly 140, 145 commercial flights a day. And I took a look at the ATADS numbers just to see what we were talking in terms of general aviation. And that came out to an average of about 30 flights a day. It's just over 1,000 acres, and there's two runways, one 8,000 feet and one 10,000 feet. So it gives you an idea of what we're talking about size-wise.
Now, your job specifically is in the back office, right? Yeah, do you have windows? Do you get to see what's going on outside, or are you sort of buried in the spreadsheets and the transactions and all?
I am. Well, I am lucky in that, yes, there are lots of windows surrounding my department, and we look out onto one of the runways. So I get to see a lot of airplanes coming and going when I'm by the windows. But they have seen fit to give me a desk that, unfortunately, when I look up, I see a wall. Very sad. So whenever my more fortunate co-workers who have window seats tell me that something interesting is outside the window, of course, they have to get up and go running. So I get up and go running relatively often.
I would think so.
But I still get all my work done. That's the important thing.
So tell us a little bit about that work. What are some of the activities that you're involved in?
Yes, I work in accounting. Now, hopefully I didn't just scare off all the listeners with that. It means that I pay the bills. There's a team of us actually that handles that. So I do everything from paying the vet bills for the canines to paying the nav aids, the maintenance bills for the nav aids. Pretty much anything else you can think of that it would take to run an airport. De-icing chemicals, jet bridge repair, toilet paper, you name it. I also am involved in recording the landing stats and compiling and sending out the landing fees, everybody's favorite thing.
So tell us a little bit about the landing stats. What do you capture, and where does all that data go?
Well, that's a good question. We actually capture a fair amount of data, and I do some of it, but I'm not solely responsible for it. So the things that we're looking at, of course, are how many landings each airline had. And that's the major airlines, plus all of the regional airlines, plus any charter airlines that flew in. We do not charge general aviation. So we're just talking commercial and charter. And we're recording how many landings. We're recording the landed weight. We're recording the number of in-planed and deplaned passengers. The amount of enplaned and deplaned cargo, the amount of enplaned and deplaned mail. I think that's primarily it.
That's a lot of detail. That really covers a lot of very specific aspects of the activities at the airport. And so how is that stuff used?
Well, it's used in a couple of ways. I mentioned earlier about emplanements. Emplanements are people who are getting onto an airplane. And emplanements are very important for an airport because that's primarily where airports make their monies, from people who are coming to the airport to get on an airplane. If you think about it, when you fly, you're going to arrive at the airport a little early. You're going to spend some time there. You might park there. Whereas when you arrive at an airport and you get off the airplane, your goal generally, unless you are connecting to a different flight, your goal generally is to get the heck out of the airport as quickly as possible. So, and recording the emplanements and, of course, the total passengers is really important. And then for the purposes of sending out landing fees, we need to know What we're looking at is the max landing weight for each airplane that comes in.
Oh, so you're not looking at the actual landing weight, which I was kind of wondering how you would end up getting that.
No, we would have to probably have scales or something like that to really make sure we were measuring that. So no, we go by max landing weight per aircraft type, and we do break it down into that level of detail in terms of recording how many landings for each type of airplane for each airline.
You mentioned nav aid maintenance, and that really made my ears prick up because I know that's a line item in the FAA's budget. Are they billing you? Is that who you're paying for nav aid maintenance?
No. So the nav aids and everything at the passenger airport, I believe, are owned by the FAA. So we are not, we don't do anything with those. But that is not the case with the nav aids at the other two airports. So those are the ones that we pay the maintenance for.
And is it the FAA that's maintaining them, or is it a contractor?
It's a contractor.
I see.
Now, the details of that, I couldn't tell you. I don't know whether the FAA is involved in terms of who we're allowed to contract that to. That I don't know. I just know that I do see those invoices come in every month.
Hmm. Do the airlines pay their landing fees on time, or is that a difficult issue? And you have to have a collection function that monitors that.
Are there deadbeat airlines? That's what we want to know.
When it comes to the big commercial airlines, no, they're very good about it, and in fact, they know well in advance what we're going to be charging for landing fees in the next year. The airport meets with the airlines, and there's a complicated formula that goes into deciding what's going to be charged. It involves looking at current year financials, looking at what the budget for the next year looks like, looking at the prior year. They put that all in a pot and stir it up, and from that they're able to determine what they're going to charge. But they meet with the airlines and present them with what they plan to charge, and the airlines have an opportunity to ask questions about it, look at the financials and ask questions about that. So, and I should say that when I'm talking about my airport, I'm talking very specifically about this particular airport. Every airport is different, so I can't speak to all airports as a whole. I would imagine many of them are similar, but they might not be. They might have their own way of doing things.
So each airport has the ability to set its own fees and so forth.
Right. So, for example, the passenger airport, the fees that we charge there for landing is not the same as what we charge at the cargo airport.
Mm-hmm. Well, what other revenue sources does the airport have? Things like parking or what else?
That's a good question. I was going to ask what you guys thought in terms of revenue. So when we talk about airline revenue, yes, we're talking landing fees. We're talking about space rental, so ticket counters, whatever office space they might have, things like gate use fees. I think they pay some kind of maintenance fees for the jet bridges, things like that. So those are things that airlines pay. But where would you imagine other sources of revenue would be?
Oh, if I were in your job, I would be trying to stick it to the airlines and do what they do to passengers. I'd be going like, oh, yeah, it's really cheap to land here at my airport. But, oh, by the way, if you change gates, that's a fee. And if you cancel a flight, that's a fee. And if you bring an extra bag, that's a fee. Can you do that for us? Because I'm sure our listeners are like, yeah, go, Jen, do it.
No. Oh, the short answer is I can't do that for you. You know, that's actually something I think that a lot of people think that, oh, you can just charge the airlines more.
They just don't end up flying into the airport then.
Ah, very good, David. Exactly. You know, we are a medium-sized airport in the Midwest. There are plenty of medium-sized airports in the Midwest, and we want them to want to fly into ours. Mm. So we're not going to We're not going to do the crazy bag fees with them, unfortunately.
Jen, what percentage of revenue comes from things like rent all the shops and restaurants that are at the facility for those people waiting to what was the new word I learned tonight?
Cinnabon. No.
No. Oh, I want to say deplaning, but it's not. What was it, Jed, you were saying?
Implaning. Yes.
Implanements, yep.
You know what? I don't have it. Well, yeah, I do have it broken out. So I'm looking at a snapshot from, I think this is through February, and around about 8% comes from concessions and leases with your food and your souvenir type shops. And airline fees, as you would imagine, accounts for a fair amount of it, but it's not our main source of revenue. There's actually one that's bigger.
Ooh, fuel flow.
Anybody want to guess what it might be?
Fuel flow.
I was just going to say it's got to be fuel, right?
No, it's not fuel.
Long-term parking. It's got to be the long-term parking.
David, you win again. Yes, it is the long-term parking. So just to give you sort of an idea, so this snapshot going back to February, we're talking roughly 34% of revenue from parking versus 32% from airlines.
Tell us where you spend your money. I mean, I'm guessing there's a lot of salaries and there's a lot of pavement.
Yeah, salaries and wages really are going to be sort of your biggest chunk of any pie, I think, regardless of your business, really. And then, of course, benefits. But besides that, yes, I would imagine, and I unfortunately don't have it broken down into as minute detail as I would like. But I would imagine that building maintenance is going to be a pretty big chunk of it.
Can I ask what my father's favorite budget line item was? You're in the Midwest. What's your budget for snow removal?
Oh, hit her where it hurts.
I did not print up the budget, so I can't tell you off the top of my head what it is. But obviously, it's something we have to plan for every year. And I'll tell you, we'll start purchasing the de-icing equipment round about August. So we start planning for it well ahead. But I can tell you, looking back to 2014, which is the most recent complete year that I have, because 2015 is finalized, but the numbers aren't out there yet for public consumption. But 33% of expenses were spent on airfield and apron. Versus 31% on the terminal.
Hey, Jen, I'm curious, does the airport own the de-icing equipment, or is that each individual FBO?
So at the passenger airport, airlines are responsible for their own de-icing as far as de-icing the airplanes. So they take care of that themselves. Now, remember what I said about every airport being different? So at the cargo airport, the FBO handles all the de-icing, and the airport happens to own the FBO. So, when it comes to the cargo airport, we are responsible for the de-icing fluid for the airplanes. But when I speak of de-icing at the passenger airport, I'm thinking more about the equipment and everything it takes to keep the runways open.
Hey, you probably don't know this, but there is an Airplane Geeks airline, and you know, we've just been talking about expanding and going into some airports in the Midwest, and you're actually under consideration. So how is that conversation going to go with us when we call you up on the phone and go, hey, Jen, you got a gate there for us?
Well, I think if someone contacted us and was interested in coming in, and again, this is not exactly my area of expertise, but just from being around and from being exposed to it, I can tell you that you would have a conversation with a number of people in management, and we just would want to see where are you wanting to fly, what routes are you looking at, and what would your needs be as far as gates, counter space, and so on. I can tell you that the airport does look pretty carefully at where passengers are going. So not just where are they getting off the airplane after they've left our airport, but what is their ultimate destination? And they will look to see if we are noticing patterns in terms of larger groups of people going to specific destinations. And, you know, when they start to see something like that, then they will start to look to see, hey, maybe this is a new route that one of the airlines should consider adding. And they will approach the airlines and talk to them about it.
Wow. So how do you know where the people, what their final destination is?
Good question. I'm not entirely sure, but I know that that data does get passed on to management because it's definitely something they watch. They also have conversations with community business leaders to find out, you know, where are they doing a lot of their traveling, and are they able to get where they want to go fairly easily? Are there routes that maybe we should be looking at?
How do you interact with the local community? I know that's not, Jen, your strong point, but what, I mean, how much interaction do you have with the local community?
You mean me personally, or do you mean the airport in general?
I'm talking the airport in general.
Gotcha. Well, that's a good question. The local community, in my mind, I think of the neighborhoods immediately surrounding the airport. Is that what you were thinking, or were you thinking more just in terms of the city, the county?
I'll let you answer the question how you feel it.
Whatever I see fit.
Well, let me give a twist to it. What about, you know, businesses or people that might come to you and say, man, it is hard for our people to get to Austin, Texas. You know, what can you guys do to help us get from, you know, wherever we are to Austin?
Sure. So that kind of goes back to what I was just saying about how, you know, they are definitely engaging local businesses, universities to find out what their needs are in terms of travel. And then they also at the same time are looking to see, you know, where are passengers going from our airport, and then approaching airlines to say, hey, we see a real need for travel to, say, the Pacific Northwest. We don't have any direct flights to the Pacific Northwest. You know, where can we go and what can we do to maybe add that? So for the case of a business that approached the airport that said, hey, I'd really, you know, would like to be able to fly to Austin. Well, it depends on your business and how many other people do you want to fly to Austin. Is there a huge group flying every week? You know, in order for an airline to be interested in adding routes, it's got to make sense for them. It's got to be something that they're going to be able to, you know, ultimately profit from. So if it's just flying three guys from business A to Austin every other month, that's probably not going to be enough to add a route for them.
Jen, one thing that's been in the news a lot lately is the time to get through security, the TSA lines and all. Is that an issue for you or for the airport? And what are the relationships like between the airport, the TSA? How do these things get resolved? Do you just have to sort of sit back and, you know, passively watch what happens?
So there's a couple of things that go into the long lines. First of all, I should say that it's my understanding that my particular airport has not been as badly affected by the long lines as you know, you hear about airports like O'Hare, where they're having, you know, two and a half hour waits. I think I read an article recently where they said the longest wait at my airport has been somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 minutes, which is still long, but definitely not miserably, miserably long.
Yeah, there's worse.
But it's an issue. You remember we spoke about emplanements and how emplaned passengers are very important to airports because they tend to be the ones that spend the money at the airport. Well, when they're stuck in line for a couple of hours and they finally get through that line and they are going to have to hustle to get to their flight, they do not have time to stop. And, you know, sometimes they don't even have time to grab a cup of coffee, but they certainly don't have time to sit and have a leisurely meal or to browse in a shop. And so, you know, I think we have seen that our concessions is off a little bit this year from where we would expect it to be. And we do believe that the longer lines is part of that. I can't really speak to the relationship between the airport and the TSA. Other than to say, I think by and large, since the TSA handles security, we try to make a partnership out of it as much as possible. So, for example, they've recently changed some of the procedures for getting the concession items back into the sterile areas. So rather than, they want to make sure that that's not going through the main security lines, that they're redirecting that a different way to get it back into the sterile areas so that it frees up those lines to get passengers through as quickly as possible.
I would think that the volume of passengers coming in is something that the TSA would want to understand and monitor. So, for example, when there are periods where you can expect lots of arriving passengers to come in, the TSA would, you know, sort of plan for that. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about, you know, sort of the data that's collected. Do you, I don't know, maybe provide the TSA with passenger load forecasts or anything like that to help them, you know, plan the manpower and the capacity for security?
I would imagine that at the very least, they have access to the schedules so they can see when the busy times are. So, for example, I want to say 6 a.m. between 6 and 7:30, 8 o'clock, very busy. And then you will find another sort of busier patch later in the day. And I'm sure that they're aware of that and they know the schedules. And they should, I would imagine, plan accordingly. But something else I wanted to point out is that the vast majority of airports were built quite some time ago. I know the terminal that I work in was built in the 50s. And so it wasn't designed with today's security needs in mind, really. If you think about what flight was like back then, it was a whole different experience. So I think a lot of airports are not designed to really facilitate moving people quickly through security. And I know that as we look ahead to hopefully building a new terminal sometime in the next, they're looking maybe 20 years down the road, that's one of the things they're definitely looking at is how can we make sure that the design of the new terminal is going to be much better in terms of security than what we have currently.
Mm-hmm. Jen, how about you personally? Did what came first, the AvGeek or the job at the airport?
Oh, well, the AvGeek definitely came first. As for how I got into aviation, it's really hard to pinpoint a specific thing. There really was sort of maybe a range of things. And David could perhaps speak to this a little bit, but I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, not far from Philadelphia. And that is some busy airspace there. Lots of flights always overhead, heading to Philly, heading to Dover. There are at least a couple of general aviation airports out near where I grew up, so lots of smaller airplanes flying over. Just as a kid, I was always really, really aware of all those planes overhead. And like any good app geek, you know, I was constantly sort of craning my head and looking up. And along a similar lines, there was someone, I wish I knew who it was, who would come out to the fields around my house, because we live way out in the country, and would practice aerobatics. And I would love to see them come out and practice, and I would make a beeline for the field, and I would just settle down and watch. It was like, you know, your own private air show. So that was definitely another factor. And then the third thing, which I mentioned on Twitter, and Rob commented on the fact that we just had the anniversary of the Battle of Midway. When I was in sixth grade, my dad decided that TV is bad, and he threw our television away. He really threw it away. So I had no television for a good chunk of my growing up years. And because we lived way out in the country, I didn't have a neighborhood full of kids to hang out with. So I spent a lot of my time reading, and I want to say it was maybe 14 or 15, somewhere in there, and I had read every book in my bookcase a million times, and I needed something different to read, so I decided to raid my brother's bookcase, and I reached in and pulled out a book entitled Midway. Really didn't know anything about it other than it looked like it had something to do with the Navy, based on the pictures of the ships on the cover. So I thought, well, I'll give this a try. And wow, I just, by the time I was into the second chapter, I was completely hooked on it. And it really, I had never really considered what aircraft carriers were before, or what they did or the role they played. And just the idea of airplanes launching off ships really fascinated me. So I really think that, and then just all the airplanes overhead all the time were sort of where it began for me.
Did you specifically go after a job at an airport?
Yes, in fact, I did. So for many years, I worked in education. I also worked at a Fortune 500 fast food company for a while. I didn't really set out to work in accounting, but I kind of fell into that. And while I was working at the Fortune 500 company, somehow the aviation enthusiast in me really opened back up. It had always been there, but it had kind of been simmering in the background. But I want to say that was probably the year that Airplane Repo came out. Now, say what you want about how real or unreal the show is. I just fell in love with the airplanes on the show. And that just sort of kickstarted something in me. And I made a decision, you know what? I really love aviation. I want to work in aviation. So I, my first thought was, well, I'm not a pilot. I'm not a flight attendant. I'm not air traffic control. So I don't know that I can work in aviation. But the company I was working for actually had an aviation department, and the aviation department had an accounting component to it. And then it dawned on me, well, hello, everybody needs, you know, accountants.
Yeah, accountants and lawyers, right?
And so from there, I started, you know, specifically looking for jobs. You know, obviously, I looked at the airport, but I looked, there's several charter companies in the area. There's a couple of different universities that have aviation programs in the area. So I just started looking and looking and looking, and finally the perfect job at the airport came along. And I've been really a kid in a candy store ever since.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I note that you enjoy, of course, is plane spotting.
Indeed.
And recently you published or you posted on your blog something called For the Love of Plane Spotting.
Yes.
What were some of the sort of the high points from that post? Share that with our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, plane spotting is such an important thing for me. And I began to think about the role that plane spotters really play, you know, in the big aviation family. And I think that they play an important role in aviation in general, but also for airports specifically. And it's probably odd to hear me say that, because I know a lot of airports, it's especially after 9/11, they've really closed off. They've had to. And, you know, maintaining safety for everyone coming into and out of the airport is a priority. And it's a big task. It's not an easy one at all. But, you know, I think plane spotters really act as ambassadors in the community for both the airport and for aviation. I think they... you know, they, I don't want to say that they're part of the security team, but they're another set of eyes on the airfield. And they're very familiar with the airfield. So they know when things look normal or maybe when things, something doesn't seem right. So I just think that plane spotters have a lot to offer beyond just, you know, they're people who like to look at airplanes. Yes, but they're more than that. So that's was sort of what I was thinking when I wrote the blog post.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, yeah, I think you're right. They do have, you know, their finger on the pulse of what's going on in and around an airport, and so that makes them a, you know, an asset to the operation. So I think that's important to embrace the plane spotting community, and you know, it benefits them as well. Sort of very symbiotic relationship, I think, is sort of the healthy way to look at it.
I think so. And so I really hope that, you know, airports, more of them will take plane spotters into consideration, and not just plane spotters, but really just the general public, the neighbors, the people who live nearby, who maybe don't know how cool airports really are. I mean, airports are really neat places. There's a lot of neat stuff going on there. And, you know, I just would like to see more airports find ways, safe ways, to allow the community to experience what's going on.
Well, Jen, you know, I have a question. What made you decide to start writing your blog?
Well, I've always liked to write. And when I started with the airport, I realized I had something, you know, sort of exciting to write about, you know, my personal experiences in aviation. Sort of up until that point, aviation was something, you know, I experienced at an air show or if I had to fly somewhere, but it wasn't something I got to experience, you know, daily, as part of the whole aviation community. And so when I started working at the airport, I really became immersed in that and realized, wow, I have something that I could share. So that's kind of why I started writing it. It's something I enjoy. Writing is something I enjoy, and the two seem to go together.
Well, it is interesting because you generate a lot of comments from the stories that you write. And did that surprise you at all when that began happening?
Yeah, actually, it really did.
Someone's actually reading this stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. I started writing just to write. I really didn't know that anybody would care at all what I had to say or find any of it interesting. And I was really surprised and, you know, very humbled, actually, at the number of people who enjoy the blog. I don't want to say you know you've made it, but I'm going to anyway. You know you've made it when you go to Oshkosh and someone's like, "Oh, Jen, I love your blog."
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Yeah. Are you going to AirVenture this year?
Indeed, I am.
Oh, cool.
Yep, can't wait.
I'm probably the only one from the geeks that's going this year, so.
Really?
We'll have to meet up.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait. I'm going to be there Monday through Friday.
Well, Jen, before we close out this segment, are there any sort of favorite moments or interesting people or things that stick out in your mind from your experience at the airport that you could share with us?
Oh, yeah, sure. So there's always interesting airplanes coming in and out. Now, being a medium-sized Midwestern airport, mostly what you're seeing are your A320s, your 737s, your regional jets. But we also sometimes have Air Force Two fly in. And then the support airplane, is it a C-17, I believe, that comes with that? You just never know, I think is the thing. You never know what you're going to see. And I love going up and peeking out to see who's parked over at the FBO today. There's always somebody interesting parked over there, and I really enjoy that. Other things I've gotten to do, we got to go on a tour of the airfield. How fun is that? We got to drive all around and see, you know, all of the different systems and just quirky little things. Like there's a graveyard marker out in the airfield. Why it's there, I don't know. I don't think anybody except the people who work on the airfield could possibly see it. Mm. But there used to be a graveyard that they moved and they put a marker in. We got to go over and check out all the equipment. So I got to ride around in a broom truck that they use to sweep the runways with. I got to sit in a snowplow. And it sounds silly maybe, but I think it's a lot of fun, and it's all part of the bigger experience that is the airport.
Welcome to my childhood.
So you can relate, right, David?
Oh, I can absolutely relate driving down the runway in a snowplow in a blizzard.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to do that, but I keep telling the airfield guys, like, all right, next time it snows, you let me know. I want to come out there. And so, of course, they say, well, all right, Jen, we'll call you at 2 in the morning. And I said, call me at 2 in the morning and I will come down there.
You realize there's no cure for what you have.
I do realize. Yeah, but
you know what that means, don't you? What you have is terminal.
Exactly.
Hey, so is it now? Can I hit eject, Max?
Yes, I think I'd be appropriate.
Bye bye.
Think about this. They've been putting up with this for a long time, probably since you were in high school, and they're still here.
Yeah, dear. So what about the stairs truck? Is that a favorite vehicle of yours at the airport?
It is. I have a fondness for the stairs truck, and it was there before I even heard about Arrested Development and how they used to drive a stairs truck on that. For me, it actually goes back to an episode of Top Gear. I don't know if you've ever watched Top Gear.
Of course, yeah.
The BBC version with Richard Hammond and Jeremy Clarkson. Richard Hammond does a segment with airport vehicle racing. So they bring out a stairs truck, a fuel truck, and a fire engine, a couple of tugs, a bus, a catering truck, and they race them around the airfield. It's hilarious. The stairs truck comes to an unfortunate end, but I highly recommend it if you're looking for a not too lengthy, entertaining video. Made me laugh, and I thought, you know, the poor stairs truck, it didn't do well in the race, but it's you know, there's a lot of uses. You could paint your house from it. You could go apple picking with it. You could take it to an outdoor concert and have the best seat there. I've given this some thought, as you can tell.
We can tell.
They'd be great to drive down the freeway. I just imagine.
Could you imagine?
Absolutely.
Of course, they're not certified to go driving down the highway, I'm afraid. I don't think they've got, I don't think the Department of Transportation has certified them for general use, unfortunately. So if I ever get one, I'm going to have to look at what I have to do to convert it.
Airbags.
Jen, you're good at, when you come and we have cheesesteaks.
Yes.
The guy down, the automotive place down the road is restoring one.
Oh.
Get out. Really?
Would I lie about a stairs truck? Come on.
I hope not. Now, see, this, I've got to see that.
Now you got her all excited, David.
Well,
I can see a blog post that says the top five things to do with your stair truck.
I've got a stairs post. It's called Those Marvelous Motorized Stairs. And I think I do cover some of those points in that post.
You must have missed that one. Sorry. Hey.
But there's always more to say.
But David had me on cheesesteak, so, you know.
Jen, tell us where we can find your blog.
So the blog, again, it's called Tales from the Terminal, and you can find it on WordPress. I think it's talesfromtheterminal.wordpress.com. And if you're also, if you're on Twitter, you can find me on there. I'm on Twitter fairly regularly. And it's Jennifer.
That's the understatement of the year.
JEN_NIFFER. Jennifer.
Fantastic. All right. We'll look for you there. Thanks again, Jennifer, for coming on the show. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a tremendous pleasure.
The Airplane Geeks need your help. Well, in particular, I need your help. You see, I'm going to Farnborough this month, and the GoFundMe page that I set up is a tad bit shy. There are many expenses associated with not only producing this show, but actually getting over to Farnborough and covering the event. And while the Airplane Geeks remain advertising free, and we really want to keep it that way, the generous support of our listeners can help tremendously in funding our adventures and bringing great field reporting to you. So again, if you have the means and can afford it, please consider going to airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016 and giving what you can. I know I really appreciate it. And thank you very much. This is Brian Coleman, Associate Producer of the Airplane Geeks.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with his aircraft of the week.
Okay, folks, I'm invoking rule number one.
Give David time to think about it.
No, I'm invoking rule number one, which is it's my segment and I'll write what I want to. And I owe the second half of the Mirages, which will be in 2 weeks, three weeks. But tonight we're going to talk about missing man formations. Saturday, my head exploded, this after a really bad Thursday. Within 15 minutes of each other, both opposing solos, commonly known as number six, of the United States Air Force Demonstration Squadron and the United States Navy Flight Demonstration Team had accidents. Major Alex Turner, Thunderbird 6, ejected out of an F-16C after doing the Air Force Academy graduation flyover. The second crash was Captain Jeff Krause of the United States Marine Corps, who crashed on takeoff in Smyrna, Tennessee. Captain Krause did not inject and was killed on impact. I'm not sure if most people know this, but I can tell you what maneuver Captain Krause was making. It's called the low transition to high performance climb. Why do I know that? Because number six has been doing that takeoff since I was little. They did it in F-11Fs, they did it in F-4s, they did it in A-4s, then they do it in F-18s. Number six rolls down the runway, retracts the gear off the runway, and then pulls into an Immelmann or half Cuban 8 and exits the field the opposite way they took off. Based on what footage I did see, something happened on the climb out. I'm not going to speculate what yet. However, both pilots flew their aircraft away from populated areas, which gets me back to Saturday. When I read the following report from WHERE TV, the Pensacola ABC affiliate. If you don't know, the Blues are based at Pensacola. They reported that the, quote, stunt team was being asked to cancel its participation in Fleet Week in San Francisco. Okay, you heard me give the official title of the Blue Angels. It's not the U.S. Navy stunt team. We need to eradicate that word from aviation vocabulary. Evel Knievel's Sky Cycle was a stunt. The Blues fly a demonstration. Everything they do can be done by any naval aviator upon completion of their training. Yes, the Blues do it cleaner and closer, but practice will do that. That normally is enough to make my blood boil, but then I read Supervisor John Avalos's quote. It's about the terror they cause in people when they strafe the neighborhoods. That's something I hear about all the time when the Blue Angels fly overhead. Well, this was a first for me. I'd never heard of the Blues strafing airshow attendants, considering one of the first things the Blues do when they get a Hornet is take out its M61 20mm cannon. Evidently, Avalos has had a vendetta against the Blues for years. I proudly called him an ass on Twitter and was promptly blocked by him. I might have to add that, a la Stephen Force, to my bio. So I was going to rant. I was pissed. I was heartsick. Did I mention I was pissed? By late Sunday, I had seen tributes being flown by my team, the Geico Skytypers, the Canadian Snowbirds, the Breitling Jet Team, and even the Golden Knights flew the Blue Angels number six and Blue Angels flags. But back to the first three. For the Skytypers, it was the second week in a row where they had to fly a missing man. They had done it the week before in honor of William Gordon, whose P-47 crashed in the Hudson River during a photo shoot. This week, it was in honor of Captain Cuss. Instead of a rant, and this being recorded on June 6, 2016, the 72nd anniversary of D-Day, I thought I'd tell you a little bit about the missing man formation. It's almost as old as aviation itself. The movie Helldiver with Clark Gable ends with the main character being buried at sea while three F-8C4s fly line abreast with a hole in a number three aircraft and introduced many to what would become known as the missing man. Although it's rumored that RAF pilots flew it over Manfred von Richthofen's funeral to show respect for the Red Baron, it was used sporadically for the rest of World War I. George V. Pryor documented the maneuver in 1935. And in 1936, King George V was the first non-RAF personnel to ever receive the honor. In 1938, during the funeral of Major General Oscar Westover, an honor parade was flown with 50 aircraft, 11 rows of five aircraft each. the second row being without aircraft. The line abreast or finger four formations minus one aircraft was the standard until World War II. Beginning in World War II, U.S. Army Air Corps pilots would fly the finger four and have the second aircraft in the flight pull vertical, symbolizing the pilot's rise to the heavens. Another variation is braking formation and flying west towards the sun. For a brief time, the United States Air Force Thunderbirds, then in Phantoms, included the missing man in the standard display during the Vietnam War. They also would let the tail of the number four aircraft become blackened with exhaust from the number one aircraft. It was a way for the team to remember those who were being lost overseas. Jet teams have continued to do them as six-ship deltas with either two or three pulling vertical. The tradition often occurs over Arlington with a three-ship to support an interment of a fallen soldier. Over the weekend, the Skytypers flew their Delta 6 with number 3 pulling up and west. The Breitling team flew their 7-ship Delta with the number 6 pulling to the vertical. Lastly, the Canadian Air Force's Snowbirds in Manitoba flew a 9-ship line abreast. Impressive flying, and with Snowbird number 1 making the call for all to hear, having Snowbird 6 pull up and out of the formation. I'll put a link to that video in the show notes. All in honor of a husband, father, pilot, and Marine who lost his life making a difference in inspiring people. That's far more important than getting upset over a jackass politician who's done nothing his whole career. So Godspeed, Captain, and thank you. And what I'm about to ask is strictly from the kid who grew up watching the Blue Angels and does not reflect the management. A GoFundMe has been set up to help Captain Cuss's wife and two children. I would ask if you can help, even if it's small, please do. I'll have Max put that link in the show notes. So with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof, sadly signing off.
Thanks, David. Yeah, the news was it was just kind of a blow. You know, I think for anybody interested in aviation, who will, of course, be familiar with the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels, it kind of hits you in the stomach.
It's funny. When that happened, I saw somebody later in the day, and they said, gee, that was too bad about that Blue Angel guy that died. And I said, no, it wasn't a Blue Angel. It was one of the Thunderbirds that had the accident. And he said, no, I think it was a Blue Angel. And I said, no. I said, and the guy punched out of the airplane. They said, no, this guy didn't make it. And I said, oh, they couldn't have had two accidents on the same day. I mean, what are the – I mean, that's never happened before, has it?
On 6-2, we lost 2 6s.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It was nuts. And, Rob, like you, when I saw the reports coming in about Captain Cuss's accident, I was sure the mainstream media was screwed up. Corey, the Thunderbird, right? It really was kind of an amazing few minutes that you suddenly both teams now are on safety stand downs and will be for a while. But it is come out basically that Captain Cuss directed his aircraft also like the Thunderbird away from the crowd and population. Unfortunately, he didn't have time to eject.
Oh, geez, I got to go. I forgot. I lost track of the time. Guys, I'm sorry. I got to run. Jen, it was nice having you on the show.
And well, thanks.
Well, Rob, I know you need to run back to your event. Want to thank you for taking the time to join us for this portion of the show. And you're going to be back full force next week?
Well, up to my old tricks, you mean?
Don't make promises you can't keep.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes, I will be back at full steam. I just want to say one quick note of thanks to the guys from Plain Talking UK that were insane enough to have me on their show Friday. And they mentioned that their show kind of evolved from the Airplane Geeks. So yet another one. But those guys were really a hoot to work with over there. They did talk a little funny, but listen, anyway, it was nice. Jen, it was nice having you on the show, and To everybody else that's listening, sorry I can't hang around for the end, but we'll see y'all next week.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Bye.
David, you're going to be off next week. Is that right? You're going to be on vacation?
I'm going to be on vacation, yes.
All right. So we'll miss you next week. And then after that, is it the week after we're at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum?
Right. So the following Monday, I don't know what we'll do.
Yeah, I think what we'll do is we'll record a lot of content at the show. So that episode will most likely contain a lot of interviews and interesting recordings from the Innovations in Flight Day. I know it's getting close to that for those of you listening, but if you're able to make it on June 18th, 2016, love to see you there.
If you are planning on coming to the dinner, let us know so I can get a count for the restaurant.
We should just take over the whole place, David.
Well, we're trying. Every year we get more and more.
Bigger and bigger. All right. Okay, we've got a little trip report from Brian. Now, Brian wasn't able to join us, but he did send along a Delta trip report. And Brian also provided some links to some information that you'll find helpful. So let's listen to Brian Coleman's trip report.
I recently had the opportunity to fly on Delta, and here's my trip report. As many of you might recall, I tend to be very vocal about my experiences when I fly, especially on United. Having flown over 3 million miles, I've experienced the good, the bad, and the ugly. Sometimes my comments are positive, and sometimes, well, let's just say, they're not so positive. But I always feel as though I'm giving a fair and balanced perspective of the situation from my perspective. For example, I still stand by the statement that the best piece of meat I've ever had in my life was on a United flight when I flew from Los Angeles to Orlando. Sure, it was a while ago, when United flew the DC-10, and they carved Chateaubriand from the aisle in first class, but it was, indeed, the best piece of meat I've ever had in my life. The rest of the meal was, well, completely forgettable, but the meat was truly spectacular. Anyway, back to the Delta story. These days, I don't get the opportunity to fly on Delta, so I've lost my frequent flyer status with them. And that's sad, because for the most part, I've always had very pleasant experiences, so I was kind of excited when I had the opportunity to fly on Delta again. I was looking forward to another positive experience, but this trip was going to be a bit different. The problem all started when I wasn't able to book my own ticket. Someone else did the booking, and I believe this person was trying to do the right thing by purchasing the least expensive ticket. However, they forgot to consider the alternatives, and as the saying goes, you get what you pay for. So I chalk this experience up to, well, for lack of better words, lack of experience, both on my part and the part of the ticket purchaser. You see, the person who booked me on this flight chose the least expensive ticket possible, which normally I wouldn't mind and I do myself. However, on Delta, this might not be the best choice for a frequent flyer, and in this particular case, this frequent flyer, and here's why. With the purchase of this discounted ticket and not having frequent flyer status, it's impossible for one to get a refund if you're not able to travel, change the ticket on the same day for any reason, and on business trips, something usually comes up, and you have to change your ticket. You cannot get upgraded to first class, paid or using miles. Nothing, just nothing's possible to get up to first class. You cannot get a seat assignment in advance. This guarantees the traveler of the much dreaded middle seat. You also board last, which means there's no space in the overhead bins for your luggage. And priority boarding is not available on this discounted ticket, even if the traveler wanted to purchase this feature. Yes, the airline won't take your money. So back to me. I cannot pay to board the plane early. I had to gate check my bag, which did save me $25. However, I had to schlep my bag through the airport, only to have to wait for it at the other end in baggage claim. I had no opportunity to upgrade to first class, even if I was willing to pay for it, and I couldn't change my ticket if my travel plans changed. Fortunately for me, this was a short flight, and there were two relatively small people sitting on either side of me. Therefore, the middle seat wasn't as bad as it could have been. The flight attendants were great, and the pilot did a wonderful job with his announcements keeping us informed along the way. I enjoyed my snack and my one free non-alcoholic beverage on the flight. It was, however, very frustrating not knowing what seat I was going to have, if any at all, until I arrived at the airport. Boarding the plane last also caused my bag to be gate checked, which stunk. All in all, the flight was okay and I arrived on time, safely. Which, isn't that the most important part anyway? If nothing else, let this piece be a warning to all those frequent flyers out there who are just a bit on the particular side. Saving a few dollars on the ticket price might end up costing a lot of money in the long run if things don't go as planned. And the little nice perks that include pre-boarding, a possible first-class upgrade, and pre-assigned seat go a long way when you have status with the airline. I hope if and when I travel again on Delta that I purchase a ticket in Delta Comfort Plus or First Class so I don't have to go through the stress again. Delta has a good product and you get what you pay for. I just wish I had the experience and the knowledge to pay a bit more. Lesson learned on my part. This is Brian Coleman, Associate Producer of the Airplane Geeks, with my brief trip report on Delta Airlines.
Max T, what's going on in your world? Anything interesting coming up?
Oh, I got to tell you, it's just incredibly wonderful to report that this weekend I'm going to be very, very busy as the first of my two daughters is getting married. So, it's going to be fun.
That's just,
they're just two sweet, wonderful girls. And one of them has, decided that this guy she's been hanging out with for 8 years is great. And we've known him for a long time. And we're just very, very thrilled. So just want to let you know, I won't be flying this weekend. I'll be having a lot more fun instead.
All right. Good. Let's move on to a little bit of the listener mail. You know, we got quite a number of emails, feedbacks, recordings, sort of based on Rob's On the Mark segment about the TSA. And we were planning on including that this episode, but I think we've got just too much of that right now. Plus, since Rob had to go back to his event, I think it'd be better if he was here for this. So we'll push that off until next week. We did hear from our good friend Ian, and he writes to see that the Snowbirds will be in Washington, D.C. He notes that they were at the local Spring Bank Air Show last summer. He did provide us with a link to a video. He said, if you're frustrated looking at the jerky and out of focus, quote, HD video that people post on YouTube, he said he put his camera on a tripod running during the show. Now, he's really edited this and trimmed it down to a few highlights, and he added a soundtrack to it. And it's really a nice video. So we'll have a link to this in the show notes. This is the Spring Bank Snowbirds. Just some really gorgeous video. It really kind of captures the event. Normally when you see videos of air shows, David, they tend to pan the camera around, try to follow the airplanes. And this is really different in that it's a stationary camera.
With good photography and really good editing. So we probably, if it was UAV Digest, it would be a video of the week. But yes, we don't do that on this show. So thanks, Ian.
We got another video. This was sent in by Jim. He says, I know the show is Airplane Geeks, but I came across Helicopter Day at the SAC Museum just west of Omaha, Nebraska. He said SAC, Strategic Air Command, SAC. Website is sacmuseum.org. But Jim writes, it was a fun day and my 2.5-year-old son was able to climb all over the helicopters and even in a few cockpits. They had helicopters from the State Patrol, emergency air transport for patients, and a few military helicopters. We were able to watch a few helicopters take off and fly away. He said, my kid loved it. Since all these helicopters were on call, the pilots were right there and talked to everyone and answered questions. I'm a private pilot for fixed-wing aircraft, and seeing anything that can fly amazes me. So we've got this little 2.5-minute video, very short. He says his son was on his shoulders and kept pulling his hair as he was trying to look around. And
that was the best part. If you've ever seen Ratatouille by Disney, that's how the little mouse controls the shell. If I had this vision of him grabbing, I want to look that way, Dad. I want to look that way.
Yeah. And the thing that I really, really like about this, even more than just sort of the helicopters, is the fact that, you know, Jim took his young son to go see these things. And, you know, this little kid, only 2.5 years old, but still, you know, you got to start Av Geeks young, right? You got to start growing them young. And what a great way to, you know, introduce your child to aviation. And then we got some feedback from Jeff in Minneapolis. He said he saw that Textron has released more details and a couple of photos of its single engine turboprop. And they call it the SETP, S-E-T-P, the single engine turboprop. He says it looks to me like they took the PC-12, a very nice plane, he says, and improved just about every characteristic. He says, I know this is a dedicated P&W show, Pratt and Whitney. No, it's not really. But he says, but this new engine leverages GE. This GE engine sounds pretty nice, he says. Garmin G3000 avionics, much more logical than Honeywell. I imagine the transition for owner-operators who want to step up from a G1000 equipped aircraft would be more less intimidating than Honeywell. Also, those windows look like they belong on a Gulfstream. So we have a link to that in the show notes. First flight on this, I believe, is scheduled for 2018, still under development. This is not an inexpensive airplane. Well, it's not as expensive as some. $4.5 million, I guess, is the unit cost they're looking for, the unit price. I guess this was announced at Oshkosh last year in 2015. So the Textron single-engine turboprop, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. The GE engine on this, this is the GE93. We'll have a link to the GE Aviation press release that kind of describes this advanced turboprop. I think that what GE is trying to do here, and we talked about this, I think, a few months ago, try to carve a little niche out of maybe more than a little niche out of what's been the Pratt & Whitney Canada
PT6
domination, right, David? Exactly. And so that's the GE93. So again, we'll have some information in the show notes. You can check that out.
And Trescott, what do you think of the glass? Is the G3000 worth it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's an upgrade from the G1000. Thus far, it's not in nearly as many aircraft, so there are, you know, a lot fewer of them out there. But yeah, it's definitely an upgrade.
All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to bring this episode to a close. We want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We especially want to thank our guest, Jennifer Adams, Tales from the Terminal. Jennifer, tell us again where folks can find your blog and Twitter and anything else you'd like to pass along.
Yeah, sure. So the blog is talesfromtheterminal.wordpress.com. And on Twitter, I'm Jennifer. That's J-E-N_N-I-F-F-E-R, Jennifer.
I think that's pretty clever. Yeah.
Thanks. And thanks for having me. It was fun to be here.
Yeah, it's been a blast having you. Maybe we'll have you back sometime.
That would be fun.
Again, Rob Mark had to get back to his event. You can find
anything with Jetwine in the name.
Anything with Jetwine. Just look for Jetwine. Twitter, the blog, whatever. It's all there for Jetwine. Max Trescott, where do folks find you online?
Oh, if they're coming out to California and they want to fly with me, go to SJ Flight, short for SanJoseFlight.com. If you're interested in the G1000 books and things like that, go to G1000book.com. And I just tweeted out that great snowbird video that Ian did. So you can find me on Twitter, Max Trescott.
Very good. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
On vacation as of we hanging up.
Okay, so we'll wait a week.
I'm looking forward to 4 days off sitting on the ocean in preparation for Innovations of Flight 16, which will be my week next week. So
cool. All right, and you can find me on Twitter. Just look for Max Flight. You can also find me on LinkedIn with David at theuavdigest.com every week. Also with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast.com. Look for us, of course, at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/404. At the webpage, at our homepage, you'll find links to all the places you can find us on social media, also how to contact us. We have a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. If you'd like to help Brian with his visit to Farnborough, this year. You can learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016. Intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro is by Bruno Massone. Find his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at brunomissone.com. That's BRUNOMISONNE. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone. We'll be right back.